Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Very good evening to you all. It is the Saturday Science Club, but we're on a Sunday and in the evening. So big changes all round. You're listening to me, Matilda Hay, and I'm joined today by mad food scientist and with a special scientific interest in beer, my good friend, Chris Clark. How are
Hello.
You doing, Chris?
I'm good, thank you. How is everything? This place is so cool. I love it here.
I know, sort of tiny and special with a little magical Soho Radio vibe of its own.
I'll come here for a coffee at some point.
You have to. Yeah. If you're listening, you can tweet us at Soho Radio, and we've got our weekly thunk for you. So this time, because Chris is our mad food scientist, we're having a whole episode looking at food and beer and particularly protein, linking that all together. And the question I want you all to think about today, we've probably all thought it, we've probably asked it as four-year-olds. Why is milk white? If you think you know the answer, you can tweet us at Soho Radio or Facebook us, facebook.com/SohoRadio, any of those things. So many ways to get in touch. But now, let's get this show on the road. So, Chris, what song are we having first, please?
Ooh, what should we have first? I'm thinking, since we're talking about milk, maybe we should have Stolen Dance by Milky Chance.
We need to fetch back the time they have stolen from us. Love more.
Mellow tones. That was lovely.
Don't you love that track?
Really like it. But it's time for science news. The coolest thing I thought, actually two really cool things. We have found the oldest ever murder.
What?
Yeah.
Who's
oldest
got
ever
murdered?
Murder case. We don't, a skull. They pieced together a skull, 52 different pieces of bone. It was found in a cave in Spain, which is literally, the cave is named Pieces of Bone, but in Spanish, so Cimas de los Huevas, or something
Ooh,
like that.
That sounds good.
And they discovered that it has two injuries above its left eye, which look fatal and as if someone else has struck the blow. So
that's so great. So that's like the most gruesome jigsaw puzzle ever. So, I mean, because then, you know, it sounds like a cave named after bits of bone. That's going to be a lot of bits of bone.
Mm.
You've got to put that together. I often wonder with these archaeology things, like how true is it? Or is it people just thinking, oh, that's really cool. Like, what a good story we can make out of this. Because you've just got so many things that could be different. It blows my mind. It's awesome science, though. How cool is that?
No, definitely. Like, CSI, but on an absolutely phenomenal scale.
So how old was it? Do we know?
430,000 years old.
430,000 years.
Okay. Oldest ever murder.
So it's Ugg hitting Ugg with a bone. Or...
potentially, or a rock.
Or Og, I don't know.
Yeah, Og or Og, Flintstone style. yeah, so I thought that was cool. What's been your favourite piece of science news, Chris?
Well, I've had a couple of favourite pieces of science news, and sadly, I am a massive food nerd, so my pieces are food related. So the first one is pretty much something about ethylene. Have you ever heard of ethylene?
Yeah, I actually always thought it was pronounced ethylene, but there we go. Those great science words where you never quite know how to say them.
The old school word is ethylene. The modern word now is just ethene, so we've shortened it up a bit to make it a bit more sort of obvious about what it's for. But this is the news that ethene is a type of gas. 50 years ago, it was discovered as the chemical that helps plants to ripen. It's a type of plant hormone, but it's really weird because ethene's actually, it comes from like crude oil and things like that. It comes from natural gas. It's very strange, and these plants use it as a hormone to sort of regulate how they grow. And we use it for all sorts of things now. So ethene is used, have you ever heard of polyethylene, for example?
Yeah.
Polyethylene. So that is the main constituent, so low density polyethylene, the main constituent of plastic bags. So in your supermarket, that's your low density. A lot of your thicker plastics, that's high density polyethylene. So that's just lots of these ethene molecules all joined together in big long rows. But in plants, it's absolutely amazing because...
So it's actually the same molecule as what you get from the oil and as what you have in the fruit?
Yeah, so the fruit makes it itself.
I did not know. It's actually the same molecule.
It's absolutely amazing. And they make this thing, and they can use it to grow the seeds at the right time. They make it flower at the right
time. Yeah, it makes things ripen. I knew that because like bananas produce a lot of ethene.
Absolutely.
And so if you want to ripen like your pear, you put it in a box with the banana.
Absolutely. So that skin really gives off a lot of this ethene, and it makes sort of the sugars, the starch in your fruit start changing into sugars. And then the pigments
so that's what
change,
makes it all sweet.
And
yeah.
It all goes delicious and lovely. But you can also use it to make things flower as well. So pineapple, if you put a banana skin next to a pineapple plant, it will flower. So it causes that
really?
Plant.
Really? How long does that take? What's that kind
so
of time
scale? It can take a little while. It can take maybe a few days with the bananas. But it's fascinating
That's
stuff.
Really cool.
But we can also now use that to control the shelf life of things, because obviously you don't want your mangoes
yeah,
or whatever
don't they
too
like
ripe.
Freeze fruit and then they spray it with ethene like in its ship on the way to the supermarket.
You can actually spray it. The best thing to do is spray it with something very like ethene. So they have chemicals that almost exactly like ethene as far as the plant's concerned, but it means it doesn't react in the same way to it, so it essentially blocks its ability to perceive the presence of ethene. And so those plants will just sit there being like, well, I'm ready to ripen now. Can I go? Nope. It doesn't matter how much ethene there is, they won't ripen. So that can extend our fruit shelf life in supermarkets. And I think
And
that's...
How do they get rid of the block then?
The block, eventually, that will
just degrade.
That will just degrade over time, and then eventually your fruit will go bad and horrible.
So, like,
but amazing stuff. So that's ethene for you, and I thought that was very cool bit of science.
Do you know
news.
How they originally discovered it? If this is the anniversary of it?
Oh, how did they find out? I honestly don't know. It was a nice scientist in his little lab, I imagine, playing with some plants.
Yeah.
Just very cool, I think. Like,
probably just realised that bananas make everything flower.
Yeah, he probably had some fruit next to a banana. I went, what? That was so nice the other day, and now it's gone horrible. So maybe
just one of those observations that you then follow through and discover something amazing.
If only I could have one of those. So that's about ethene. And I have one more piece of science news, which I do think is super cool. I'll try and be very quick. Now, this is the science of plating up. So when you go into a fancy gourmet restaurant, you see all those plates of food and they look gorgeous. They've clearly spent way too long making you look pretty.
Yeah, it's all about presentation.
Exactly, because obviously they haven't put any actual food on the plate. You know, they've missed a good portion out. So this is a study by Oxford University, which has been looking at how intimidating onions can be.
Intimidating.
Onions are terrifying, especially pickled onions.
Ogres are like onions.
Exactly. They are just scary, scary foods. And so what their study has been about is about the orientation of plates. So they half some pickled onions, crack them on a plate. And so obviously a pickled onion has like a pointy end.
Okay.
And they have put that in front of a bunch of people, and they have found something very interesting about whether people will be more or less willing to pay based on the orientation of the plate.
No way.
Now, I've got a picture of this here.
Which we will be tweeting later for anyone else that wants to see. Okay, so I'm looking at the picture now.
Looking at the picture. Now, which of those orientated? So we've got, just to describe the picture, we've got three halves of pickled onions on a plate, and some of them are pointing up, so the pointy bit's pointing up, some to the right, some to the left, some down. Now, do some of those plates look more appealing than others to you?
I guess. So, yeah, I mean, they're all really similar. Then you've got the pink pickled onion and a green thing sort of with them in a kind of triangle shape. And I'm feeling drawn to dish one, where it kind of has the triangle almost pointing to the right, rather than down or up or to the left like the other.
Now that's
have.
Very interesting, because you are actually among some very few people. A lot of people are more drawn to picture two, so the top right where you see they're pointing up. So you can see, so they've done big studies on this, including at the Science Museum. They did a citizen science experiment with about 1,600 people. And generally speaking, I can try and show you the probability, so we'll put this up as well. Here we go. So if you look in terms of, we've got a circle here showing the angle the plate is orientated. And around the circle, we've got a little chart showing how many people liked the different orientation.
Oh,
and
wow,
it shows
that's really
that the
strong,
onions
isn't it?
Pointing directly upwards was hugely favoured by everyone. And it's thought that having onions pointing towards you, the little sharp bits pointing towards you, is quite threatening. So it's thought that you're scared of the food on
your plate.
So any triangular objects pointing in your direction are perceived as threatening psychologically. And so people generally prefer it much more if it's pointing in completely the opposite direction to that. And I think really weird.
That is crazy.
Very obvious.
I would never have thought that, you know, the orientation of my food would... So was it how much they'd pay or how likely they were to buy it?
How likely they were to pay money for it.
Right.
But now you can see why chefs get so irritable when their waiters just take their carefully prepped food. They just take it, put it on the table. They always specify usually which way around they want that plate facing when it goes down. In posh restaurants.
Yeah, yeah. The Michelin
which
stars
I do not frequent because I can't afford it.
I've definitely, when I back in the day when I waitressed, I definitely got shouted at. Not really for plate orientation, maybe I wasn't in fancy enough places, but like if your gravy kind of slopped over the edge or something.
Oh, I was a definite gravy slopper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I poured a nice creamy latte all down some nice woman's dress at the table. It comes with those stupid little wobbly, you know, the tall glasses.
Yeah.
Thin bottom, wide top.
Yeah.
They're not
designed. Centre of gravity is far too high.
It's madness. And I had no chance. So, yeah, I got in trouble for that.
My dad once poured gravy down someone's neck. So, that's definitely the
gravy burns. Nothing worse.
Not good. For our final piece of science news, just quickly before our next song, it's really exciting because this is happening today, Sunday, the 31st of May. There is a solar plane called Solar Impulse, which
is
absolutely no fuel and is powered entirely by light from the sun using 17,000 wing-mounted photovoltaic cells.
Wow.
So literally like tiny little solar panels on its wings. And because of this, it has huge wings, like wider than a jumbo jet.
That makes sense.
But it's actually a tiny aircraft. It's only designed for one pilot and its entire weight is about the weight of a car, like a normal sized car. And it's doing a round the world mission.
Wow.
It left Abu Dhabi in March. And
it's a good place to start if you think about it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's made its way to China in six separate legs. And now it's going to go from China to Hawaii. Now, all of the other legs, the longest they've been has been about 23 hours. So nothing more than a day that this pilot is flying a plane. The journey from China to Hawaii is going to take the pilot 5 or 6 days. And
that is terrifying.
He's on his own. He apparently is going to try and stay awake as much as he can and going to have cat naps throughout this time. He's been doing lots of mental preparation, apparently. And, if they've had to wait for a month in China for the right weather conditions, because obviously it's so important that they have clear skies for this plane and, if possible, a wind in the correct direction.
That would help.
And he's basically, once he gets past the halfway point, he can't turn around and go back if something goes wrong. So he's got to, like, they've got this whole backup plan of, if you go down in the water, bail out and wait in a dinghy and we'll pick you up.
That is a brave man.
Yeah, if he achieves it, he will have broken the world record for the longest duration single-seater plane journey.
Wow.
And, you know, I thought, like, this is crazy. We're never going to, if they need, you know, that many solar panels just to fly one person, it's never going to be sustainable for jumbo jets with loads of people. But it's not really to show the future of aircraft, just to demonstrate the power of renewable energy in general.
Well, all I can say is that he's going to have a horrible time when he realises he's got to fly to England, especially on days like today. Oh, well, good luck to him. That sounds fantastic.
Excellent. Yeah, I know. I'm really keen to see how they do. So they took off today. There you go. Some live science news to follow.
Oh.
And now for our next song, Chris, do you want to introduce it?
All right. Well, we're talking about ripening, and I love my tenuous links on track. So I'm going to go with Peaches by the Presidents of the United States of America.
I'm moving to the country, gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. Peaches come from a can, they were put there by a man in a factory downtown. And if I had my little way, I'd eat peaches every day, sun-soaking bulges in the shade.
Peaches for free.
We're back.
What everybody wants. And on this delicious summer evening, I think it's time that we talked about everyone's favourite summer activity, barbecues.
Oh my God. Now, barbecues are so absolutely fantastic in every single way.
What is it that makes barbecues so delicious? Why do we come back to them again and again and again?
Well, now, it's mainly because of the temperature of barbecues and also the fact you're cooking with smoky substances. Now, we all love smoky flavours.
You get the lovely smoky flavours.
You get that fantastic smoky flavour, and you also get nice colours coming off from it. So when you're burning things like charcoal briquettes, let's try that one, then you're getting nitrogen-based compounds coming off. So there's a bit of nitrogen coming off the charcoal in smokiness. And if you've got a moist surface on your meat, then it tends to infuse into the meat and mix with some of the pigment colours, which is called myoglobin. It's essentially like an oxygen carrier in muscle.
So you are literally getting sort of little tiny bits of the charcoal
that smokiness are getting in there, and they're making these fantastic aromas and these lovely colours. And if you do a really really fine barbecue that's been smoked over a long time, you can get sort of these nice a pink ring around the outside of the meat, which is very interesting because you'd normally expect the colour to be very pink in the middle, sort of undercooked. But if you cooked it really well, then you get these sort of nitrogen components coming in from the outside into the surface of the meat, mixing with the pigments of the meat, and it changes it to this lovely pink colour if it's smoked properly. And you call it a smoke ring.
Yeah, because there's actually a lot of science in barbecuing, isn't there? I mean, there's a lot of ways they can go very wrong, as sure all of our listeners will be able to testify to. I certainly can. I've eaten my fair share of basically meat that has become charcoal itself.
That's pretty much it,
But yeah, there's a bunch of different reactions going on. Can you tell
me
about those?
There are so many different reactions. So to start off with barbecues, the important part is just getting the temperature right.
Okay.
And that's the really close attention, listeners.
Chris is going to give us the best way to make the perfect barbecue.
Now, that's a big statement. I have a lot of people contesting this. But I would say the best thing you can do on your home standard barbecue is to be testing the temperature with your hands. Now, be careful. Don't shove your hand in the fire. But what you want is no flames at all. Now, as soon as you've got flames going on, those essentially are little regions of very high temperature that will push your meat way further than you need it to go. So you don't want the flames. Wait until you've got sort of a very orangey glowing charcoal with a slight white dusting on top. And that's when you're ready to sort of start testing the temperature. So as soon as the flames have gone, your barbecue will be at its hottest. And that can be sort of up to sort of 200 degrees Celsius, a little bit higher.
The
actual coals the coals themselves might be about 2000 degrees Celsius, but your putting your meat a little bit above that, and you've got all the radiation coming off, heating things up. So what you want to be doing is you want to put your hand at the height you're going to be cooking your meat. And ideally, if you can hold your hand there for about 3 to 4 seconds, and that's about the length you want to be able to hold there before it gets too hot and you have to take your hand away, that's a great cooking temperature.
Ooh, okay. So you have a hand test, 3 to 4 seconds.
3 to 4 seconds.
Perfect barbecue temperature.
And that puts your temperature at roughly, this is a very rough test, but 175 to 190 degrees Celsius. And that is a great place to be because you get a lot of very cool reactions. And the big one you're looking for with your barbecue is something called the Maillard reactions. And this is a very complicated set of reactions, but ultimately, Maillard reactions happen in anything that have some protein and a little bit of sugar. And meat is great for that. So meat, you've got some of the residual glucose from when the animal's still alive, and you've got the proteins, which are the muscle fibers. And what happens is, the bits that build those muscle fibers, the bits that build the proteins themselves, called amino acids, they react with the sugars. And this reaction only happens between 140 and 165 degrees Celsius.
Wow.
It's very specific. And if you don't go hot enough, you'll never reach that. And these reactions produce a browning colour on the surface of the meat. You get this lovely brown colour, and it produces the most complex and wonderful aromas of meat. And that's essentially the essence of meatiness. It's not just meat it happens with, it happens when you're baking bread. So when you're browning bread, you get that lovely bready smell. That's the Maillard reactions, producing super complicated chemicals that you're smelling, and it is fantastic.
Or like if you fry something in a pan, like onions or bacon, like anything that browns, is that what's going on?
That's the main thing that's going on if you've done a good job and it's smelling fantastic. That also you can go just a little bit higher, so 160, so the top end of the Maillard reactions, to about 190, and this is still sort of the region you'd be cooking in with your 3 to 4 second test, then you're getting caramelization reactions happening.
Oh, yes,
so
wow.
That's when you're getting sugars themselves actually starting to just slightly change their composition, so they're sort of breaking down into simpler sugars, and you're getting these lovely sort of toffee, caramel-type smells coming out, and that really adds to the browning and also the flavours. So you're getting a lovely sort of caramelly, meaty, just a fantastically savoury aroma coming off your food. Oh. You can tell I'm really passionate and into this.
This is like food porn. I want to eat a barbecue right now.
Well, get your barbecues out tomorrow, guys. But that is the key. Now, where we all go wrong on barbecues, it's always when you get to the high temperature stuff. It's people cooking too early. It's when you go past 190, you start pushing into 200 degrees Celsius, and that's when you start getting things like pyrolysis. Now, pyrolysis is get a bit nerdy on you here. That's from the Greek word pyro.
Fire.
Which is fire, and lysis.
Separate.
So it's separating by fire. You're literally tearing apart the natural molecules that make up your meat proteins, and you're making ultimately carbon. You're leaving carbon behind. So it's actually called, if you go too far.
Oh, and that's why it looks black.
You go carbonisation. You've just left a coating of carbon molecules around your meat. And that's why you get those sausages with that cracking crust, which is terrible. Tastes horrible.
Yeah.
And the pink inside, which is dodgy, you've got to watch out for that. Don't let your sausages be pink in the middle. There are bacteria that need to be cooked. So never eat a sausage that's got pink in the middle. But ultimately, you're looking to get away from those pyrolysis reactions, especially because in fats in particular, when you pyrolyze fats, they produce something called acrolein. Now, acrolein is a toxic chemical. It's horrible and it causes irritation to the throat and eyes. So if you ever overcooked oils and fats and you're sort of coughing and spluttering, that's pretty much the acrolein going into your eyes and getting into your throat and irritating things. So you want to avoid
doing
that.
Thought it was just the smoke from the charcoal that was making my eyes bleed.
I mean, it's part, they also get bad chemicals coming off the charcoal. Yeah. But ultimately, when you start burning food and fats, that's why you start coughing and spluttering
a lot. So the key is all in the temperature.
Get the temperature
too low,
right,
and you miss out on the great flavour. Mm-hmm. Too high, and you're going to make carbon and acrolein, essentially.
Exactly. So it's all a case of messing around with that temperature. And if it's all about practice. Nobody's perfect at barbecuing, but my God, it's good to stand around trying.
Absolutely. And on that note, while we've all got fantastic food images in our head, let's play Food by Ghost-Faced Killer.
Liking it. Now it's showing and proving, keep the body moving. Exercising the mind is scientifically proven to increase your lifeline, strengthen your heart. Eat fish, that brain food will get you smart. Yoga, deep meditation and tactics. You know good than just practice, cause practice makes perfect. Stop burying the lies and bring the truth to the surface. Money is the root to all evil, that cash rule will have you out there looking like a damn fool. That's the devil's bait, the almighty Dollar Tree will have your mind fooled by technology. Make the right choice, no need for an apology.
Thank you, Ghost-Faced Killer. Very lovely rendition of Food. Well, you are listening to the Saturday Science Club on a Sunday.
What?
There you go. And we asked you at the beginning of the show, why is milk white? Stay tuned because we are about to find out the answer. This is the part of the show where we do our weekly experiment. And if you are listening, all you need is some milk, some tea towels and bowls, some ethanol, or apparently a very good vodka will do, and some lemon juice. So all very easy ingredients to find. And we are going to be answering the question of why milk is white with our experiment. So Chris Clark here with me today. What are we doing?
Okay, so what we're going to do now, we've just been talking about barbecues and a lot about protein and things like that. And this is a perfect example of why milk is white. This is down to protein. We are going to be performing a protein extraction.
A protein extraction live on air.
It's about time we see these damn proteins that we've been talking about, which is very exciting. And this is all about why milk is white. So can I tell our listeners yet, or are we going to tell them at the end of the show why milk is white?
We can tell them
Can I reveal? I would love to reveal. Okay, so the thing about milk is, you see it as this very white substance. It can be quite thick depending on what sort of milk you've got your hands on. But ultimately, the structure of milk is fascinating. It is mostly water, but it also contains some milk sugars, so you might have heard of lactose. So people who are lactose intolerant, that's the sugar in milk. You've also got some fats in there, and you've also got a lot of protein. And the protein mainly forms these tiny little balls, very small, so we're talking thousandths of a millimetre here, but they are completely all through the milk, so they're very nicely dispersed around, as well as tiny droplets of fat. So ultimately,
and that's the curds and whey, right?
So essentially, the curds and whey. Oh, we'll talk all about curds and whey any second.
Oh, right, okay.
Now, we are going to make curds and whey.
Oh my God, exciting!
So you've got your balls of protein, your balls of fat, and they are just all through that water. But what happens then is that as light's trying to pass through that milk, it's all reflected back off the tiny little balls of fat and protein, and it's scattered around, and it's reflected back at you. And what that means is that you've got all the wavelengths of light, so you get, you know, red, blue, green, yellow, etc., etc., and all together that makes white light. When those are all scattered off the particles in milk, you get a white milk, and it's
opaque,
white reflection, and it's opaque because the light can't get through it anymore.
It's being scattered out.
Exactly. So that's why milk is white. But we're going to take this a step further. We're going to show this by extracting some of that protein and seeing if we can make milk look a bit...
Proving that, you know, it's not just...
We want to remove some of that
paint in water or
exactly.
Something.
Exactly. So let's do this now. I'm going to get Matilda to help me out with this. We've got here a glass of milk. And what we're going to do first is we've got our little bottle. And we've got... Has it got to do some sloshing?
Yeah. So what are we putting into the milk first, Chris?
So first we're going to get the lemon juice and you're going to take the top off there. And you're just going to pour that in. Just give it a good slosh. And don't be afraid of it. It loves a bit of lemon juice.
Oh,
there
I love
it goes.
Lemon juice too.
That's fantastic. Now, what we're doing now, you give that a good stir.
Okay, let's stirring away.
That. And yeah, it's looking pretty good. Yep. And already you can see on the sides of the glass, or you will be able to see, that there's small like sort of balls, little bits of white stuff. There's little bits of white stuff coming on the side of the cup. And what's happened there is that our lemon juice has essentially coagulated the protein. And what that means is that those nice regular balls are now of protein starting to form little clumps. They're all grouping together, and so they're becoming much bigger than they were initially, so we can start to see them. So what we need to do now is we've made curds and whey, essentially. So those white bits are curds.
Okay, so are they fats or protein?
So the curds are a little combination at the moment of fat and protein. And then you've got this sort of liquid, which is still some sugary fattiness all around it. And what we're going to do is we're going to strain that off. So I need to pour that in the tea towel.
Okay, so the milk is now being poured into the tea towel.
And the tea towel, just so everybody knows, that is in a bowl right now, because otherwise you're going to make a hell of a...
would go straight through.
It's going to be absolutely horrible.
I would get in a lot of trouble, so Soho Radio would not be looking so good right now.
Now, Matilda, I need to pick up the sides, and you're going to essentially try and squeeze that out into the bowl.
Squeezing the milk through the tea towel.
Now, what you can see there, you'll see the liquid coming out of that milk. Well, you can't see it yet. You will be able to see when you do it at home. The liquid coming out of that milk is pretty much clear. And that is because you've got most of that protein coming out of it now. So you just get the good squeeze.
So basically, the proteins and the fats are getting stuck in the tea towel.
That's right.
And the watery part of the milk is coming through. And it really is. It's so much clearer than what we first put in.
And that's, that is your whey. When you hear about people talking about Little Miss Muffet, tough eating a curds and whey, that is the whey there, and the curds are left in that tea towel. And this is a very basic way of making a simple cheese. So this would be essentially like cottage cheese or like paneer, as you find in some restaurants. Now, I'm going to get you another bowl to put all that. There's a very horrible white slimy residue in that towel.
Yeah, that's
now.
My cottage cheese going
that's
on.
That's the cottage cheese. And I'm going to get you another bowl to put that in.
We'll be tweeting a photo of this first, though, because it really is looking quite special.
It's a really grim experiment, isn't it?
Yeah, it smells interesting as
and
well.
And it smells dodgy. I mean, the wonderful thing about this experiment is, now, the key thing here is, in a minute, we're going to be using some chemicals.
Should I be scraping it off?
We should be scraping that into our bowl.
Okay, I'm scraping it off.
We're going to be using some chemicals based on ethanol in a minute. Now, when you do this at home, I suggest you use a nice, strong vodka. Now, obviously... You know, don't drink if you're underage.
But get your parents to help you.
But ultimately, if you're using vodka, it should mean the results of this experiment are edible. Would you believe? Now, we haven't actually got any vodka in the studio. I'm using something called bioethanol, and that is
not edible.
That is something you use as a bit of a lighter fuel sometimes in various home cookers.
That's
and things
fine.
Like
I don't think I particularly want to eat.
So I personally,
cheesy
I mean,
protein mess.
It does
anyway.
Taste. Absolutely awful, I'll be honest. But you know, maybe right. I haven't perfected it yet. So, okay, we've got a bowl here and we've got it full of our curds, which is our simple cheese. Now, next, we're going to get this bottle of ethanol. I'm just going to squeeze it in.
How much ethanol are we putting
just
in?
Just go nuts. Enjoy
loads
yourself.
Loads and loads of ethanol
That's
going
right.
in. Fab.
And this will work better the stronger the alcoholic content that you're using. So use nice, strong vodka. Or in our case, this bioethanol
is 95%
proof, which is very strong indeed. And so what we're going to do is go and mix that up together now.
Doing some more mixing. Ooh, yeah.
And now that mixing, you've got the ethanol, and the thing about ethanol is that it allows fat to dissolve in it. Now, fat, if you normally put some sort of olive oil on some water or something like that, that will all separate.
They're
It'll
immiscible,
sit on top.
Aren't
exactly,
they?
They're immiscible.
They don't
fluids.
Mix together.
They do not mix together. However, fat will dissolve in ethanol, which is why we're doing this. We're trying to get rid of all the extra fats now that were in our protein.
Yeah, and what I can see right now is, so we had something that did look like cottage cheese, a big white lumpy fatty mess, and as I'm mixing it with the ethanol, it's all become like much much smaller white particles floating in this liquid. It does look like some of it's dissolving.
It's all very grim. So once you've done that, you've done a good stir there, that's probably good enough. And what we're going to do now is we're just going to pour that into another tea towel in a bowl. Again, very important that the tea towel is in a bowl, because you'll make a mess. That's very good. Now, at this point, we're going to grab the sides again, and it's just a case of doing some more squeezing.
So,
and this is pretty much the final
squeezing the liquid
stage.
Through again.
So squeezing liquid through, try not to get it everywhere. Now, you should be careful with ethanol, because it is flammable, and it can be sort of, it can make your fingers feel a bit funny afterwards. So it can make them feel, essentially, because it's dissolving some of the oils on the surface of your skin, which are fats, then your fingers can go a bit, feel a bit prune-like, almost, like you've been, like you spent too long in the bath.
But, so I've done that. I've squeezed the ethanol through.
That's right. And what you're left with there, now, you saw that we had, it wasn't a very large amount of milk that we had. We had maybe sort of 50 millilitres, but we have got a very large amount of this lovely weird white protein. Now, how does that feel, Matilda?
It feels kind of soft almost.
It feels soft, but now if you rub it between your fingers, it also feels slightly sort of, it's probably still a little bit wet, might do some more straightening, but if you do this at home and strain it really well to really get that liquid off, then you'll rub it between your fingers. That's the oddest texture. It feels kind of springy, but also quite...
A bit kind of rubbery, but not
but then
stiff
as
enough
you
to be
sort
rubbery.
Of,
yeah.
You know, rub it to
soft,
your fingers.
Soft, rubbery.
And then it goes grainy after a while as the ethanol starts to dissolve. And as I say, if you're using drinkable sort of vodka or something with a high alcoholic content at home, at this point you might want to do the whole process again, just adding a bit of water to sort of essentially wash the protein and dissolve off some of that extra water. But then that should be something you can try yourself. But there you have it. You can see there that we've got left here, we've got this sort of quite clear liquid down there, and we've got our little towel of protein, which is what made the milk white.
And from literally about 150 millilitres of milk, we've got a good solid teaspoon of pure protein.
And that is why people say that protein is such a massively fantastic source of protein.
All these protein shakes, just have a milkshake.
Have a milkshake instead. Much more tasty. I had protein shakes. Not for me.
And taking us out from that, we're going to move from milk into red, red wine.
Red, red.
So everyone who told us that milk was white for proteins, which was actually nobody, you would have been correct. I think that's amazing. I think it's a sort of question a four-year-old will ask, why is milk white? And now we know, because it's got proteins and fats in it and they scatter the light. Incredible. But we're not just here to talk about milk.
No, indeed not.
We've only got less than 15 minutes of a show.
Less than 15 minutes. We can do this.
We've got Chris, mad food scientist, beer expert here, so we have to talk about beer. I'm so excited.
Well, okay, the first thing I'm going to do, so I've got to be lightning fast now, is I've got to open a beer. So I've got here a nice, IPA here, which is an India Pale Ale. Very, very tasty indeed. I've got a bottle opener, don't worry. If I got this down. Oh, here we go. I'm going to pour it in. You might hear the splashy noise.
There we go.
Isn't that a lovely sound?
Such a lovely sound. This just brings so many good memories.
Now, the first thing to notice about when you're pouring a beer is about the fact you've got bubbles forming. And bubble formation is a very funny thing. It's called nucleation. And it's actually not as easy as you might think. So, because bubbles are forming all through the whole drinking process. So mm-hmm. It's not just like they don't just all disappear. So you've got the carbon dioxide molecules, individual molecules of carbon dioxide dissolved into the liquid beer. And in order to form bubbles, they don't just leap out of the glass. They have to gather together into groups.
Yeah, because I guess one molecule on its own isn't enough to be a bubble.
One molecule is not a bubble. That's just a molecule of carbon dioxide.
A bubble is like a party of carbon dioxide molecules.
Exactly right. So, to be honest, it's more thinking of it as like teetotalers. You know, you've got all these carbon dioxide molecules in a beer, and they really don't want to be there. And so, they're all going to get together in a big group and have a little AA meeting.
And rise up
and get out of there. Yeah. So, and that doesn't just happen instantaneously. It's all about chance and the way those molecules, they might meet by chance, and they have to be orientated in the right way. And when there's enough of them have formed in that right way.
So do they have to stick together? Is that why they need to be
orientated? They have to get into a group, and they stick together in a very specific way. And that is the nucleus of a bubble, after which you've made a surface, and then those bubbles can start forming bigger and bigger as more carbon dioxide molecules sort of latch on.
Right.
And that's formation. Now, that doesn't happen very easily. As I say, it's by chance. So what you need is somewhere for those bubbles to get together and have their little party. They need a meeting place. And ultimately, the best thing to have there is little scratches or bits of dust and things like that in your glass. And
so something that makes the surface less smooth.
Something like that, yeah. Just a little crack or something that allows molecules to latch on and stay still. And then it's easier for them to sort of group together in that little spot.
And be in that correct orientation.
And then eventually they get to go and make bubbles.
Right.
So if you ever looked at a really dirty pint glass or one with lots of scratches, you'll find little points on that pint glass where you've got loads of bubbles coming up in a little stream.
I've definitely seen that from my glasses in the pub, where you just see a point where loads of bubbles are forming and growing up on their own.
And you've just got to just check this out in the pub, you'll see it really easily. But the best place to look is usually at the very bottom of the pint glass, because I mean, these bubbles are forming all the time, and they are replenishing the beer head, which is what makes a pint look very lovely. You know, some people don't like head. Personally, I'm a big fan. And it's been found that aesthetically, it's more pleasing to have a beer head. So brewers now, they put their pint glasses in the pubs, and every single one of them, or all the big ones, will have etched with a laser their logo or a specific design onto the bottom of their pint glass.
Yeah.
They've intentionally scratched it so that bubbles will start forming from the bottom and replenish the beer head.
I literally thought it was just, here's my glass with a logo.
You see, most people just think, oh yeah, as I drink, I get to look at the whatever
branding
logo.
Everywhere.
Yeah, but in fact, that is
nucleation.
For a reason. And so if you stare at the bottom of your pint glass, you'll see the little bubbles rising from particular spots, which is quite cool.
Awesome.
So that's pretty interesting. Now, I'm going to move lightning on to a different aspect. And this is, all about bubbles. And we're going to link this into protein. Now, you wouldn't believe it, but beer actually has a fair amount of protein in it. Because ultimately...
I would not think that.
Very strange. But I mean, a lot of the protein can be filtered out in some of the more commercial, mass-produced beers because they like it to be very clear. But in a lot of more craft beers, so I've got a nice IPA here by a certain craft brewery, which is very nice indeed, but they don't do it quite as much filtering, and you have a lot more of the proteins that are left over from the malt, and the malt is just barley that's been allowed to sprout a bit and then cooked up and then fermented. And so you've got proteins left over from that, and those proteins essentially coat the surface of bubbles in beers. They like to stick to the surface because some bits of those proteins, they really hate beer. They're a bit like the carbon dioxide themselves, so they'll like want to cling into that carbon dioxide in the bubble, and the rest of it will really enjoy beer, and they'll be stacking it on the outside. So essentially you have like, it's almost like a Velcro strip around the outside of bubbles, and it makes them really rough.
So basically you're saying it's a molecule where half of the molecule is sort of hydrophilic, it likes water, and the other half is hydrophobic and hates water, and so it goes into the carbon dioxide bubble where there is no water.
Exactly that. Now we have a conga line of teetotalers and drunkards, and they're sort of doing little conga around the outside of your bubble, which is fantastic. But that has some cool effects on beer bubbles. So if you put a glass of decent, like quite pale beer, it's quite helpful to have pale beer, you can see what's going on, and you put that next to a glass of lemonade. I don't know, my glass of lemonade's not bubbling as much anymore. I poured it a little while ago. But ultimately, if you compare those two, then you'll see that the bubbles in beer rise a lot more slowly than the bubbles in a glass of lemonade or something like that. And that is because beer bubbles are coated in this protein, which makes them drag against the liquid as they try to rise up.
Resistance.
It is resistance, and it's all about fluid dynamics. And ultimately, yeah, so those beer bubbles in...
So we're saying that there's no protein in the lemonade, and that's why the bubbles...
Little, if no protein
so
in the lemonade.
So the carbon dioxide have no resistance to their
bid for escape. They're really smooth. They'll shoot off like grease lightning. They're happy. The beer bubbles, they can go sort of like a millimetre a second, like 0.1 millimetre a second. It depends on how much protein's in your beer, but they can go very, very slowly in a good pint.
You really can see this. I urge you, listeners, get yourself, next time you're in the pub, get your pint and get a soft drink and compare. Look at the speed of the bubbles in each of them. It's actually really cool to see. It's noticeably slower in the beer.
It's very strange. But then one more aspect, I know we're running swiftly outside, but I want to cover it anyway, and that is that also to do with these proteins. So you've got your bubbles, they're covered in proteins, and that actually makes them into nucleation sites on their own, because they've got this sort of, we talked about having sort of a rough surface or a chip somewhere. Now your bubbles, once they're covered in protein, they act as nucleation sites on them on their own. So as they rise through a beer, they tend to sweep up extra carbon dioxide molecules, and that is why if you look at the bottom of a glass, beer bubbles are very small. By the time they reach the top, they can almost have doubled in size.
Oh, that's so cool. I never noticed
which
that.
It's very strange, but you don't really notice it normally, and most people would tend to think it's just a pressure difference. They think you've got lots of beer sat on the top, that's crushing the bubbles at the bottom, and so they're much smaller at the bottom. But I mean,
they're just gathering friends on the way.
They're just gathering friends on the way. I mean, if you actually wanted to double the size of a bubble between the bottom of a beer and the top, your pint would have to be seven stories high for that effect to happen.
Just with pressure.
Just for a pressure process for it to make that happen.
Whoa.
So, I mean, it's a hell of a pint. I mean, don't get me wrong.
A seven story pint,
you'd see that effect. But
breaking many records.
It is literally just down to proteins, which is, I just think it's fascinating, because people don't think of beer as having many proteins in.
No, not at all.
So, I mean, that is just a couple of little things you can look at in the pub, have a chat with your mates, you know, just check it out. It's really interesting. But just to round things off, I've got one more little experiment here, which I'd just quite like to do with you. And this relates to barbecues and things like that. And this relates to how cool your mates think they are when they do something called beer tapping. Have you ever heard of beer tapping?
All I think of is like how you get served in a tap room and you can get beer on tap when you draft it out of you know, when you pour a pint. But we're not in a pub right now, so...
We are not in a pub right now, I'm and confused. We do not have any beer taps. But what we do have are a couple of bottles of lager, as you might have at your standard... Ooh, listen to that. As you might have at your standard barbecue. Now, what we're going to do, I'm going to put one of these bottles inside our glass bowl. Our tin bowl. Rattling around in there. And now we're going to try not to make a mess of the studio and get in big trouble. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to sharply tap.
Oh, I do know this.
You do.
So when you go and you hit someone else's beer on the top.
That's right. That's when your mates
get
think
the microphone
they're
in there.
Super cool and they ruin your beer. So here we go. And there it goes.
Yeah, and then the beer absolutely floods and froths, and the froth goes everywhere, and it's really annoying because you've got a really fizzy, frothy beer.
And in the meantime, people think they're really cool, and it's so funny. It's not funny.
I mean, I've definitely
clever.
Tried to do it back.
I mean, I've done it too, obviously. But,
I don't
start. It's never funny or clever to waste beer. So,
no.
Now we're going to call on all our beery knowledge so far to look at beer tapping. Now, what happens when you bring sharply another bottle on top of your bottle is you send a pressure wave, a shock wave, down through the glass of your beer.
Yeah.
And a shock wave is just a compression wave. It's essentially scrunching things up and then making them expand
so
quickly again.
So I just want to guess. You said bubbles form from nucleation points.
Indeed.
Does the pressure wave pushing everything together, does that kind of force them into those orientations and make more nucleation points?
To an extent.
No,
to an extent,
that's a no.
To an extent. It's a three-stage process. It's a very complicated process that only got solved relatively recently.
Ooh.
But what happens is the pressure
cutting
wave...
Cutting edge here on Soho
Radio.
It is
cutting edge stuff. And as it goes through the beer, that pressure wave gets those existing bubbles that were there in the first place. And it squashes them down and then expands them again.
Okay.
And what happens then is, as those bubbles quickly expand, they break apart.
Ooh,
so
okay.
Those bubbles that were there initially, they've got small, tried to get bigger quickly, and then they've broken apart into lots of smaller bubbles.
Mm-hmm.
So what you've got now is you've got the initial number of bubbles, maybe times 10 or times 100. You've got loads more bubbles than you had before.
But they're all smaller.
Now, you've got a much bigger surface area now of gas bubbles. Okay, so you've got all those little bubbles.
Yeah.
They're all covered in their proteins. And all of a sudden, they're sucking up loads more carbon dioxide because they are nucleation sites. So you've increased the nucleation sites, as you were saying.
But just, I didn't quite get the process correct.
It was close enough.
So we've got more nucleation sites. Great.
More nucleation sites. You've got more gas going into those bubbles. Those bubbles get bigger very quickly. And the way hydrodynamics works, so the way bubbles rise in beer glasses, is it rises quicker at the centre. Okay, so the bubbles rise very fast at the centre. The bubbles at the edges get pulled down back towards the centre. What you end up with is a rotation. You end up with essentially a bubbly smoke ring type affair rising up through the middle of your glass.
Ah.
But as that swirling occurs, so you've got the beer being dragged around from the edges into the centre, you're dragging extra carbon dioxide molecules in, and then you're getting more of those carbon dioxide molecules going into the bubbles. The bubbles are getting bigger, so they rise faster and faster.
And that is why
bigger
everything
bubbles rise
just
faster.
Has to escape.
And suddenly, you've got this huge foam of liquid and bubbles all being dragged together and shooting out the top of the glass.
So you've got so many bubbles, it's actually just taking the liquid
with
it.
You've got so many bubbles, it just drags the beer out with it. And that is why beer tapping really ruins your drink.
Wow.
Heavy stuff. Have a think about it. Maybe listen again to that one just to get the full whack of it. But that is why it's really annoying when you're at a barbecue and someone taps your beer.
But fascinating. And you can just get them back by explaining the science behind it. Chris, this has been absolutely fascinating. I have learned so much and I cannot wait to go to a barbecue and put it all into practice.
Oh, thank you.
We are running out of time, sadly, but we're going to have one final song. So what would you like to end on?
I don't even remember what I gave you. What have I got? What have I got left?
Do the mashed potatoes or pour some sugar on me.
Oh, let's have pour some sugar on me. Why not?
Pour some sugar on me by Def Leppard. Def Leppard. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
Bye, guys. Sometime in the town, sugar miss sweet. Little missy innocent sugar.